Hello, welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm here to talk to Kiran Desai about her novel, The Inheritance of Loss, a remarkably self-confident novel, because it seems to me that it does some things, both jumps of geography and of time, which I think many novelists would find quite a prospect to get away with. I mean, I don't know, when you started it, did you think of it as a structurally ambitious novel, or did the structure, the two narratives, as we'll talk about in a second, and a sort of moving backwards and forwards in time a great deal, did that seem a natural thing to do, or did you sit down with a kind of diagram of it?
No, I had no confidence at all. And it was written out of a supreme lack of confidence, this book. And I was very unhappy during all the 8 years, and happily unhappy for all the 8 years it took to write it. But the structure was not a strong decision made at the beginning out of being sure of myself. It came out of the story itself, and realizing that all these bits and pieces, and struggling, really, it was the last thing that fell into place. And I realized the story itself had forced the structure.
So I mean, the obvious thing to a first-time reader is that after a couple of chapters, we realise we've got, as it were, two stories in two places, although they're connected. We're in two, we move back and forth between one group of characters in the foothills of the Himalayas and another character who's the son of one of the first group, who's working in kitchens in restaurants in New York, and we move back and forth between these two stories. Is that sort of geographical rift which goes through the novel, was that something that evolved rather than something you decided?
Yes.
Yes.
And it is also because I find that I am not a novelist who can decide on a plot, and I'm extremely envious of novelists who write like that, of people who make a whole plan, who can write it up on their wall, chapter one, chapter two, or like Nabokov, all their note cards, and then they shuffle them, and when the note cards are in place, then they can begin on their novel. Or I remember going to Oxford, Mississippi, and looking at, what is his name? Faulkner's plan, and it was all there written on his wall. One, two, three, four, this, that. And I envy people like that so much. And I think that maybe because of the life I live, I'm sort of forced. I don't have a narrative, really. I don't have a story, an automatic story to tell, a whole story to tell. So I tend to go the wrong way around, you know. I go backwards into finding a novel. And this book, I think I just wrote in every direction, one character leading to another, one episode to another, realizing I should go back in time, reading old memoirs, getting new ideas, writing about my experience of New York. And then I had, I think, 1,500 pages. This huge mess, was really scared, and had to force myself to read through it all, make connections, see, oh, there's a link here, there's a bridge here, there's a pattern here. And maybe it, in the end, was a sort of attempt to make an aesthetic pattern, or even perhaps a musical pattern. You're sort of just coming up with a way to put this narrative together. And I find that I always hope that I would learn something, and I hope that my third book, next book, would be different. But I find I'm doing the same thing. Same thing. And I've heard other novelists have told me you're the only one I know who does this.
So the structure of the novel, it's more like a kind of arrangement that allows you to put in the things you want to do.
It's also searching for meaning that doesn't come automatically, you know. It's not there. It's somehow been broken into pieces. There isn't a whole entire intelligence, and I'm forced to go at it differently. So I'm interested in other writers who write like this. You know, I'm thinking even of people like Kundera, who is so different, of course, different landscape, and yet you see why he structured his work the way he did. Or
maybe, actually, that's one of the reasons quite a lot of the readers who love the novel do so, because sometimes, I mean, they're, for instance, one of the things that I like most about it are passages, I suppose, of in some ways quite straightforward description of particular places. Mm. And almost what's enjoyable about some of them is there is no necessary narrative purpose to them. I'm not being shown this in order to move me somewhere or tell me something, except to tell me what a place is like or what a scene might have looked like.
Yeah, and some people, you know, in a way, some novelists, I think, structure a novel or a whole narrative for those passages. Yeah. You know, you have that image first, whatever it is. I remember someone telling me that reading Capote, and he had a scene where the train stops and the butterflies come through the train, and the whole point of the whole narrative, really, in the end, you realize, was for that image. And I think that is true of me, possibly because I also don't have a plot and I don't know where I'm going. So I tend to dwell on lines. You know, I tend to sit for a long while. And because I'm a slow writer and I don't know where I'm going, years are going by. Meanwhile, so I turn on the, you know, put on, I write by hand first and then edit on the computer, but a lot of my time is just spent staring at the screen or staring at the page, looking at the lines, looking at the image, and mulling it over in a very, you know, cow-like way, just sort of chewing the image over and over and over again. And so in a way, I think when you, if you write like that, you tend to focus very much on the lines, the images, they come to a standstill. You focus differently.
And you do this thing, I know, I mean, I wrote about it, or tried to write about it in the first of my columns on the novel.
Oh, I like
the
column very
well,
much.
that's good. Well, I mean, for those of you who are not assiduous perusers of my journalistic output, I tried to discuss in my first of my columns the way that, I mean, it's a novel, because I'm sort of obsessed with things like how long chapters are in novels, and you know, because I think
like,
that always...
That's a nice obsession. I know other critics who, you know, count the number of times you repeat a word and say, oh, you use nice 5,000 times. Or,
well, no, well, I don't, I'm not obsessed at all in a sort of fault-finding spirit, but I always think that's how you experience a book, you know, like, so, and nobody ever talks about things like that, do they? They never talk about the fact that when you're reading, you tend to, especially if you're reading at night, you always want, you want to get to the end of a chapter before putting it down. So books with very long chapters, you read in a different way from books in short chapters.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost a physical thing. And you use, for the length of the novel, a lot of short chapters, but also the chapters are sort of, I wouldn't say chopped up, but they're split up into these little sections, I'd call it, by these sort of horizontal lines across the page. And almost every page of the novel is split up like this.
It wasn't planned.
It just happened.
I think it was really, once I had all these different episodes, all these different stories across time and different locations, I couldn't lose all the different strands. And this book doesn't really have a plot. So much, you know, it doesn't have much of a plan. No. It's really, the momentum comes from drawing this pattern between, you know, different emotional parallels, historical parallels, and in order to make those links, I had to cut and paste.
Yeah.
So I began to hop around, and then, you know, certainly New York has that restless feel anyway. It almost feels like an airport of a city. Things are happening so fast, you feel that people are moving and different things are intersecting. And in a way, India's like that too, just because of the number of people. You know, you open the window, 20 stories fall in to your window. And every morning, and the way people interact and the way voices and different stories interact, in a way it's similar. I think for all those reasons it became this choppy structure, but I didn't realize it.
Yeah.
There was other people who...
Well, I think it's very striking. It's very... This is what the experience of reading it is like. And I mean, one of the things that it involves, I mean, to be a bit more specific now, is that it allows this sort of unannounced movement between the present and the past of some of the characters. So, the page I'm looking at is the judge is sitting at supper with Sai and Guyon, and he's slightly tormenting the latter, and he's making him eat lamb chops with peas and potatoes.
Yes.
Even though he disdains all sort of, or perhaps because he disdains all allegiance to sort of colonial trappings. And they're talking about poetry. That it says it was now 40 years since he had been a student of poetry. And then there's a break, and then you just go into his recollection of going to the library in Cambridge years and years earlier and reading odd books about India. And there's no announcement of that transition. It just happened in the novel. One of the effects of that for me was that because he is particularly preoccupied by the or haunted by the past, it seems to... I mean, lots of the reviews said that Sai, the young woman, was the central character. To me, he became the central character because that back-and-forth movement... A lot of the time happens in his head, I guess.
It is true. He was the first character I thought of, so you're right. He was the center of it all, for me. And although my grandfather was not such an ogre, he was also a judge who had the same history, so it was very close to the family background. And I think when I began writing this book, he hadn't been a central figure in my childhood, but I realized he had been a very important figure. He had been the one, from my father's side anyway, to have started this whole journey from a very rooted world where, you know, a tradition, community, it had all gone back as far as anyone could remember. That landscape was ancient. You had no, you know, just went back in time. To making these huge journeys, to breaking those links, to turning away from religion, from community. He really broke away from his family, never practiced Hinduism. We grew up completely irreligious, which is very strange in India. And, you know, for the sake of a vision of a larger India, for secular nation. So in giving up that, and make, you know, he gave it up for something bigger, but it was a very harsh, difficult process. Obviously, in whatever, I don't know, the character of the judge, you don't see much of a gain, but in terms of an idea of India as a nation, you see what people really, what really did, how it was really actually made. This is what it took.
And he was in the Indian Civil Service.
He was in the Indian Civil Service.
My grandfather, too.
Really?
Yeah, yes.
Really? Oh, we have a link. They may have been in the same...
Talk to you about it over a drink off.
Yes, and he went to Cambridge, just like the one in my book. And we have all family photographs of him with a white wig in villages, holding court with, someone holding an umbrella over his head. So he was a very interesting character. We didn't understand him at all. His face was really a mask.
Because your fictional character, the judge, I mean, his story is a pretty harsh story, isn't it? We don't, as it were, realise how bitter it is until quite near the end. But, I mean, he's sort of... I remember quite near the end, he recalls... After we know the truth about his wife, which is quite a tough story to read about, his behaviour towards his wife. And he remembers meeting his father again. And after his father's found out that his wife, he's returned her, hasn't he? He's returned his wife. She's been rejected by her own family and had to go off and live with her sister. and with their daughter. And his father, who's invested so much in sending him off to Cambridge, says, it was a mistake to send you away.
Yes.
There obviously is a kind of connection between the history of his marriage, which seems a harsh and cruel, and where his behaviour is harsh and cruel, I think it would seem to most readers, and the story of his ambitions, that he's been sent off to this cold place to learn to...
Yes, I actually have sympathy for the judge, although other people may not.
Well, you go very close to... I mean, you it's almost as if you're sort of daring how far you can go and still just keep our sympathy.
I think it's because it's not just the story of one person, you know. My memory of my childhood, of the stories told from the past, from books... You read other memoirs, other civil service memoirs. This was a common story, that men were sent abroad. They came back changed. They were incredibly cruel towards what they saw as the past or what could drag them down into the past, because there was a feeling that you could not be successful unless you ruthlessly got rid of your past. Mm. And I have a lot of sympathy because when I, you know, immigrated to the States, you see a very similar things happening. You see people being... There's a lot of cruelty in immigration. You see people really thrusting the past away in very cruel ways. And that line that the father says to the judge, it was a mistake to send you, is, I think, something that is said among modern families today, too. You know, people are sent abroad, huge efforts made, lots of sacrifice, and then there's the shock. The parents are alone, you know, living wherever in India, left behind. The children become very ruthless, joining this new world, realizing that if they take everyone along with them, they won't succeed. It's a horrible situation. You know, this is a story even common to the great names, people like Gandhi and Nehru. We all know that their wives were not really allowed to join and could not really join in their lives. They were sort of put away in the back room.
But your character does... I mean, he does more than that, doesn't he? I mean, he...
He sends his wife home and back, returns
her. Yeah,
he
sort of rapes her.
Yes.
Doesn't he?
Yes.
And... Yes. Yes. Well, not sort of, he does.
He does.
And... It's odd that, I mean, I agree, yeah. I do feel some sympathy for him. It's odd that I do, really.
I know, but then I also think that, you know... I should also say, I mean, this is a really interesting thing when it comes to this huge journey that was taken. You also realize that, India is very locked into, still into class, certainly also into caste. This is an odd, the fact that the British were in India and it was a merit-based exam and a real decision into Indianize the administrative services. This was the reason why he could break through these barriers of class and caste. Mm-hmm. But joining a very difficult system, you know, he was a judge in a colonial system. I mean, I don't know how someone like my grandfather, someone like the judge in this book, could tell right from wrong in a system that is sort of fundamentally flawed. I was another matter in this whole thing. You're taking someone from a village to Cambridge. Can you imagine the amount of shame someone feels? And then the whole question is, how does this amount of shame manifest itself in a personal sphere and then in a political sphere?
I had a big argument with a friend of mine about the book, about the dog.
Yeah.
About the dog. And about how... because we decide in the course of this argument that how sympathetic you were to the character for funneling his feelings, his good feelings, you might say, into the dog, depended rather how keen you were on dogs yourself.
Yes.
And because, you know, the dog gets quite a lot of space, especially at the end of the novel. He's tormented by the fact that the dog's been stolen. I mean, it's quite... Again, it's a slightly risky thing to make... This man who we know from his own memories has been so cruel to his wife.
Yes.
You know, have all and is at best negligent of his servant, the cook, I mean, at the end, he's beating him too, isn't he?
Yes.
But the dog he cares about so much, sleeps with, gets special meals for.
Yeah. Again, this isn't invented to me. It all seems very close to a lot of people I know. And a lot of, you know, the people writing about dogs in India today. There have been quite a lot of articles recently in the press talking of how much dogs are in families, wealthy families are looked after much more than the servants. You know, the servants are sleeping under the stairs and the dog is living a grand life. And you go to these new areas of New Delhi, on the outskirts of New Delhi, they're dog analysts, psychoanalysts. The dog are relatives. They took their dog to one and they said the dog needs his own space. And a special room was given to the dog. The dog is, I think, descended from Caesar's mastiff, they say. And then another, I was reading recently in the press that there are all these matrimonial ads for dogs now. That families like this are advertising for the exact right breed. Then they'll say, you know, we have a lovely gentleman dog of such and such personality looking for a lady of such and such. And you see this disconnect happening, which is very, I love dogs and cats and all animals myself, but there's something very strange going on.
Well, you know that Sir Walter Scott said that one infallible way of showing the reader what a character was like was showing you the character with his dog.
Really?
Yeah, well, Sir Walter Scott novels have all got a dog in.
Really?
Every single one has a dog in. Huh. And it's always a very distinct dog. Perhaps you're following a great literary
Maybe,
habit.
I'm thinking because my next book, I think, also has a dog, so.
And what about the other, some of the other characters who sort of enact some of the consequences of a sort of relationship in particular between India and Britain? I mean, Lola and Noni, they're the ones who I think lots of people kind of are most amused by, although their fate becomes less amusing near the end of the novel. Well, I wonder if you could talk about their fate at the end of the novel, because they seem happily preoccupied with Agatha Christie and P.G. Woodhouse.
Yes, and that is a nice life, of course. But I know so many characters like that too, and you always find them up in the mountains, up in the Himalayas, where I think you can somehow perhaps maintain that image. A lot of people, and so that my childhood was full of characters like that who had retired up to the mountains in the hope of, you know, living that life, mist and Englishy flowers and reading, managing to keep that vision intact in old houses that had been vacated by the British. My aunt lives in one such house, and I remember her telling me how she bought it, a very beautiful house. And she said she was a young woman. She's a doctor up in the mountains in this part of the Himalayas. She was walking, saw this huge ruin, the roof covered with ferns, gate fallen in. She walked in, didn't think there was anybody there, and then she heard a voice saying, "Who's there?" and made her way into this bedroom and found an old English woman in a brass bed, completely blind and being eaten alive by maggots. Yeah, and she'd be a string from the bed to the bathroom so she could go up and down. And she had servants who had abandoned her, who would leave food in a corner. And all around were very glamorous pictures of her past life in tea plantation area. And her family, she died. The nuns on the convent looked after, same school I went to when we lived in that area, St. Joseph's Convent. And then nuns would, I think, go up and look after her a little bit. She died, and then her family, she didn't have any immediate family, they sold the house, and my aunt bought it. And everyone says the house is still haunted. But then when we were there, and I was 14, 15, and my parents had a house there, all up, we would go there every summer, and then eventually my mother decided she wanted to write there, and we went and really lived there for a while, just the two of us. And it became clear that that class of Indians that had moved into these old houses was also sort of mistaken in its staying power. You know, we were so sure in our story being the central story, and the firmness of our location. And then it was right at the time of a lot of political trouble. And suddenly, you know, realizing that actually our story was not the main story. There was something else going on, much bigger, much vaster, as it was our idea of belonging there was just a matter of perspective. Mm. And left.
The place in the novel, Kalimpong, I mean, it is, I sort of assumed it was a fictional place, I think, for a while. Mm. And then I must have read something that, and I got it on Google Map, you know, and there it was. I mean, why did it have to be a particular place?
It was important that it was a particular place, I think. in this instance, but it was really, and I think it's really because I am an immigrant writer, you know, I feel that places are sort of vanishing. And I may be condemned eventually to be writing about places that are not real places. Mm. And yet I think still a novel, you know, I do feel as if the novel is tied to location. It's a form that's tied to place. And while I believe it should leave the drawing room and acquire a sense of movement, you know, for me it was really Jane Austen, R.K. Narayan, Vikram Seth, people like that. And I think these days with so many people moving, it has to be able to move also. And yet it still felt that it was extremely important to hold on to those to those real things, you know, people are still.
Of course, if you make up a place, or
which people are doing, you know, when I read Naipaul's later books, for example, it's a country that maybe this one or maybe that one. It's a place that maybe this one, maybe that one. But I think he's lost that distinctness that made books like A House for Mr. Biswas, which was a great novel. Yeah. So it's always terrifying for a novelist to realize that that may be going.
Yeah. Lola and Noni discuss his books, don't they?
Yes.
I can't remember which of them says, "Oh no, I think he's too preoccupied by."
Yes, one says he's not keeping up, but that he's obsessed by the past. And
I wanted to ask you about the ending of the novel, because there are lots of things sort of unresolved, which perhaps you could have chosen to resolve if you wanted to. Mm. But the one bit of closure you get, I guess, is that Biju returns. Is stripped of all his, everything he's gained, all his money and his clothes and his possessions, and so returns in a lady's dressing gown at the side of the mountain. I mean, was that always going to be how it had to end?
No. Like the rest of the book, I didn't know how it would end. You know, I couldn't end it, I think, simply or clearly or easily. And Biju comes back in that way, but that's a clear vision of him coming back in that nightgown. But it was also to refer to a deeper journey and realizing that this way of going back and forth and moving, it is enriching in many ways. You do gain stories, you do gain a larger picture, but the loss is also, you have to say, it is at the there is a cost to it.
So he's not even going to be allowed his money, is he? I mean, I remember when I read that, I thought, of course he's got to lose his money. I mean, that's completely logical. I felt disappointed for him, but I saw that.
Well, he had a worse end, actually. So
he had a what in an earlier draft?
Yes.
Well, you're allowed to broach that now. Oh, you got the Booker Prize and stuff. You didn't tell us about that.
And then too often.
Yes.
And that also didn't seem realistic. You know, it's just if I was trying to gain a balance.
But he was going to be killed or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. By those guys who rob him. They were going to kill him.
No, luckily not that bad, but yeah. But
well, the means is... Yeah. But he was he going was to... Going he to wasn't, so he wasn't going to be reunited.
The landslide was going to... Nature was going
and
to
did you
win.
Write that? You wrote it?
Yes. I wrote it and then I realized that it was too dark and too painful. And there was that glimmer of hope. He came back. He made an emotional decision over an economic one. But also the young girl, Zai, I think there's a moment of hope.
Yeah.
With her, a moment of maturity, at least.
Yeah. I've gone on far too long. So I resign now and give anybody here the chance to ask a question or to say anything you'd like to Kieran. Yes, sir.
I'm intrigued by the ending that truth is apparent from Kanchenjunga. And it makes me think of natural things somehow holding knowledge of the future. I think of Jerome Kern's Old Man River, who must know something but don't say nothing. And he knew about the future for America, and it was good. I wonder what Kanchenjunga knows, and is it good?
This book is so tied to that landscape. And I always wonder, because I have moved and I have left India, I always wonder how much of what one is, you know, should be tied or is deeply tied to that. And it's interesting, this is not related to my book, but I was watching a documentary recently on Tibet, which is, of course, very close to where my book is set. And really wondering, I mean, can a religion continue if the landscape is gone? I mean, if people have to leave and they lose that, they lose the sight of those mountains. And then when you really see those mountains, you see the monasteries on those mountains, and you really think, oh, it all seems so closely linked. The imagery, the thoughts, the philosophy. And if you leave it, how much do you lose?
There's a lady here.
I loved the novel, I did find the ending very sad and in a way unnecessarily sad because I felt that the hopeful character in the book was Bijou. And the way he'd struggled in America and then came home was such an achievement. And then to have everything stripped away from him, I felt, no, this doesn't feel quite right.
Yes, it does seem it does seem bleak. And I think when I think of who the most successful character is, I think it is Said from Zanzibar. And to me, somehow, he has decided to succeed at whatever the cost, you know, at what terrible things happening in the background, and yet, this is, I suppose, the point I wanted to make, that you can't succeed as an immigrant. I know very well when you are in the States, there's a certain vocabulary. If you adopt it and you adopt a certain way of thinking and a certain spirit, you're fine. You can go, but if you really stop yourself and you're honest about what you're doing, and what the world is really made of, and of these in-between places, how much there's so much hypocrisy involved in being able to be successful, is in my class, definitely. I suppose this book was a way of trying to uncover uncover that honesty, because I realize how simple it is to go the other way.
Gentlemen.
Can you just ask the title? What made you choose that one? Which others did you consider? And at what point in the 8 years did you decide that that was the title of the book?
That's a good one.
At the very end. And I didn't know what to call the book. And then I thought, oh, maybe I'll call it The Inheritance of Loss. And I was telling two friends, both of whom are very successful writers, and they said, oh, Kieran, what a terrible idea. What a horrible idea. It's not a sexy title at all. No one is going to buy this book. It sounds like a self-help book. And then I was telling my father, and my father said, you should call it not the inheritance of loss, you should call it the loss of inheritance. At least everyone can understand that right away. So my first, and I was just, at that point, I was really so bad-tempered and stubborn after 8 years. And everyone was wary of this book in the first place. And I was just, getting more and more, I think more and more stubborn through the whole process. Everyone was saying, get a job, finish your book. And I was becoming more and more like a mule, and I just pushed through with this title.
Well, I think it's a wonderful title, actually, because I think it conveys all the poignancy of migration and loss. And I just wanted to say that first. But I also wondered if I'm right in thinking that the characters never tell each other how they feel. Nobody ever shares their feelings with anybody else. And I wondered if that was also connected up with the sort of divisions or the fragmentations of the chapters.
Maybe. I mean, a lot of people have said to me that this doesn't seem a very Indian story in that it's so fragmented and people seem so separate. But then I always think of my own experience of a landscape, even with a lot of people in it. And I think you find privacy in different ways. And I can think of some of my closest relatives, really, and you live side by side, and yet there's a huge division. The person is still mysterious to you. And certainly in the experience of immigration, it seems to all become even more so. And the worst is, I think, not only do you not know what the other person is thinking across the divide, and you don't know, you know, the people, your family members, the people closest to you, you don't know what they're doing, you don't know the whole their life story. Now it's a bit better because this, you know, there's email and phone calls are cheaper, but even 10 years ago, 20 years ago, certainly it was very different. You really lost. You lost touch. You lost day-to-day touch, ability to really know what, you know, I didn't know what my father was doing day by day by day. And he grew very distant. Maybe we recovered some of that towards the end of his life. But the worst is, I think, when there is this break, you and a break across a power divide, you know, you're going to the Western world, a poorer world, richer world, people grow very distrustful. And I find it's very frightening. I mean, I think I may try and write about this more in the future, but I think you really sort of imagine things. You know, you imagine the worst. People grow very suspicious about very, very, very personal things. It's amazing, I think, how many stories and untrue things get churned up just because you don't know. And people don't say, no one is honest. No one tells each other their lives honestly, either out of shame or out of pride.
What the lady says is also true, though, isn't it? Of the three characters in the house, that we find out all, you know, a lot about them.
Yes,
but it's really true. But very rare. I can't think of anything we actually find out through dialogue, which is for some novelists, you find out most about people from dialogue. Mm. Whereas your sort of fictional method, I don't know if this is if I'm of understanding you, takes you find out a lot about the people, but they don't find out about each other, do they? So the reader knows, but they don't.
Well, it's very hard. I mean, I'm thinking of, for example, my father and our family cook, very much close to the character in this book, and this is the person who was closest to my father. They lived, I mean, my father died a year ago, which was very bad 2 years for me. But the person he was really closest to at the end of his life, who saw him all day, every day, for years they'd been together, all day, every day, shared, you know, they'd seen each other through so many illnesses, this problem, that problem. And yet there wasn't even enough vocabulary there for them to speak to each other. You know, there wasn't even a language big enough. He was, a cook was a Bengali speaker, spoke some Hindi. My father spoke Hindi, but mainly English speaker. But there was no emotional vocabulary because the class divide had to be maintained also beyond simple language. So, that's a very much, I think, a lasting tragedy of India, how that class divide is maintained, not just through emotion, not through economic manipulation, but through emotional manipulation, through the vocabulary, how you speak to one another. You know, the cook isn't even given a name.
Lady, near the back.
We've had a lot of talk about how the end is not a happy ending, and you've said how you didn't feel you could have a beautiful ending for the book, but that's exactly what it was for me. I felt there's such a strong theme of redemption running through middle to end, and even though it was certainly not happy for a lot of people, everyone is sort of waking up to things that were not, perhaps they were not fully presently aware of around them. And with Guyon and Sai waking up first to passion for the individual and then to more political deep passions. Yeah. In the end, I did find it a beautiful and almost happy ending.
Thank you. And I think I tried to end it at moments of transformation. or moments of a world becoming more complicated, or a bit of growing up for someone like Zai, realizing that she was not born into a simple world or simple landscape, that there could be some gain in loss, in losing many things.
Do we have any more? Oh, yes, gentleman at the front.
I was very intrigued at the Borges poem at the beginning.
Yes.
Did that inspire you to start? Did you choose it afterwards, or did the publishers choose it?
It really inspired me. I think it was my companion through the whole book. Yes, I probably from before I began this book all the way through. Because he said it all in the poem.
Could you tell for those especially the podcast listeners what the poem's about?
Oh, the poem is called Boast of Quietness. And in a way, it almost feels like an anthem to the shadow classes, you know, to the classes who have no name. And it seems so relevant to today's world, where you think that there's this extremely boastful side, this brightly lit side, this advertised side, to this large, globalized, multicultural, good-looking world, and then there's this underbelly, which, and you begin to wonder, are some people winning because others are losing? I mean, this is really the heart of the book. I mean, there's a successful world, much praised, and then at what cost? And this poem seems to really say it in very few words.
I've been asked if I could announce what the next book club is going to be. Mm-hmm. So to my 12-year-old daughter's delight, the next book club is Terry Pratchett, who's going to come and talk about Unseen Academicals on the 14th December. So quite a kind of shift, really. Mm-hmm. But all within the ambit of the Guardian Book Club. And just to say, having made that announcement, to thank Kieran very much for coming all the way from New York.
Thank
just
you.
To talk to us.